Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. In 2016, American University professor Ibram X. Kendi published a book called the history of American racism called Stamped from the Beginning. It earned him the National Book Award for Nonfiction, with the judges stating that the book, quote, turns our ideas of the term racism upside down. That same year, novelist and poet Jason Reynolds was a finalist in the Young People's Literature category for his book Ghosts. The two of them met at the ceremony, became friends and admirers of each other's work, and now they are collaborators. Stamped: Racism, Anti-Racism, and You is a remix of the National Book Award winning Stamped from the Beginning. It comes out today, and the remix is interesting. This version of Stamped reorients American history, and it blends it with Reynolds' vibrant and accessible prose written with young people in mind, like when he imagines Thomas Jefferson as the kind of person who says, I have black friends. Ibram X. Kendi, who is the founding director of the Anti-Racist Research and Policy Center at American University, was here last summer to talk about his previous book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. You write a lot of books, man. And he and Jason Reynolds, who was recently named the National Ambassador for Young People's Literature by the Library of Congress in January, joins me in studio as well. Nice to see you both.
Hey.
Hey.
So how did it go from you guys meeting and saying this would be nice to meet you, to writing this book together?
Well, as you mentioned, we met at the National Book Awards series of events, and you know, I got to know not only his work, but really his mission. And I found that we had similar backgrounds. We both didn't really read much in high school, and he was on a mission to make books accessible to young people. If young people aren't reading, it's the book's fault, not those young people. And then, you know, that combined with his prose, I thought he would be the perfect sort of person to remix this book.
So he asked.
Yes.
And I was like, nah. I was like, absolutely.
Nah, I'm busy. Nah, I'm not sure I can do this. Nah.
Nah, I'm not sure I can do this. Honestly, you know, I over the last 10 years, I've been trying to be very clear about my limitations and honest about the things that intimidate me and where my insecurities lie. And, you know, just, I think it's healthy, right? And so I think in that moment, it was like, no, I don't know if I have the intellectual capacity to manage this. And also, I don't know if I want to tinker around with something that I think is so profound, right? It is a whole thing already, and I don't know if I'm interested in chipping at it to transform it into something else. But he kept asking. He was persistent, and eventually I said yes, because I think, one, I realized that I needed to respect the fact that he respected me, that he saw something that maybe I didn't see at the time, and two, I needed to sort of swallow the fact that some things are bigger than the two of us, and that this conversation has nothing to do with me or him or our work together, but everything to do with what we leave behind for the young folks coming up.
Was it intimidating because the subject matter is so important?
It was intimidating for a few reasons. One, I don't proclaim to be a scholar. I wasn't very good in school when it came to this kind of work. I could have never made Stamped from the Beginning. It is not in my quiver, right? And so there was that. And then also, because it is such a tremendous the magnitude of the conversation and of the topic, I think it's heavy stuff, and you don't want to get it wrong, because the stakes are far too high, especially if you're dealing with kids.
And to that point, when you thought about reworking your work for young adults and for young children who are so impressionable and will take information in and do things with it in their own brains, what kind of conversations did you have about how you wanted this presented, your work presented to young people?
Well, I think very early on I realized that really a book that was effective in really reaching young people, really transforming young people, really allowing young people to learn this complex history, would have to be completely different than Stamped from the Beginning. Would have to be written in a completely different register, would have to have a different tone, would have to be written, again, in a completely different way. And so I was ready for that to happen, although in a way it's like one of your babies being reborn. But I knew the baby had to be reborn in order, again, to reach young people.
What is a word remix? I know what remix means when I hear music. So what does a word remix mean?
You know, I think it just means a reinterpretation, right? A translation even. I like to think about this book, not so much an adaptation, but a translation. How do we take these ideas and put them through the filter of young people, the filter of youth, and what does that sound like on the other side?
Was there anything that was, to say, you know, things get lost in translation, was there anything that you found particularly challenging to translate that could have gotten lost in translation?
Oof. There were some moments that were complicated for me to figure out ways to make clear. I mean, even just trying to explain how the Democratic and Republican parties, how over time they changed, mm-hmm. right? Because right now in our world and in our media, the term Democrat and Republican are sort of pumped through the airwaves nonstop. Kids are very familiar with sort of what their parents represent themselves as, so forth and so on. But historically, their sort of principles and the way they moved were the opposite. And so trying to explain how that happened and to show that shift was a little slippery, and trying to figure out how to get that right. But also even thinking about the Missouri Compromise and trying to get that right, even though they learn about those things in school, to really get it right and to address it and show all the context around that compromise was also mm-hmm. an interesting thing to figure out how to nail down.
My guests are Ibram X. Kendi and Jason Reynolds. The name of the book is Stamped: Racism, Anti-Racism, Racism, and You, a remix of the award-winning Stamped from the Beginning. So you two did an interview with Nicole Hannah-Jones, who, of course, spearheaded the 1619 Project. And during the conversation, she said, who you are writing for and the audience you are writing to are not necessarily the same thing. So how do each of you think about why you write and for whom you write?
I mean, I try to think about the general public and more specifically, everyday people who hold racist ideas but don't necessarily know it and are open to transforming themselves. I think those are really the people that I write for. And because I do think that there are actually many Americans who are very well-meaning who just don't really know. I also think, rereading some of my books, that they're really also geared to Black people. And especially Stamped from the Beginning and How to Be an Anti-Racist, and certainly, you know, this book. But I don't necessarily think about that I'm writing towards Black people. It just, you know, comes about, and maybe because I'm a Black writer. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, same. It's interesting because in fiction, actually, much like in academic and scholarship, we are always taught to not worry about who you're writing for, right? It's like a thing, like it's like a faux pas in fiction, right? As you hear Toni Morrison talk about it, you hear Baldwin talk about it, everybody will say, I write for me, I write for me, I write for me. And this is how I know that none of them wrote for children. Because it is impossible for me to say that I am writing for me when so much is on the line when this book comes out, because there are children who this book is going to be marketed toward, and I am not a child, mm-hmm. right? And so I think for me, I always approach my work with children in mind. I have to. I don't know why we run away from this. I have to. I approach my work with children in mind, and because I am a Black man who was once a Black boy, who was raised in a Black household, my natural leanings, my natural voice, and sort of where my tone and intentions are often directed happen to be to Black children. All children are obviously, you know, we want everyone to read the book. And I don't think that we should be afraid to say, look, ain't nothing wrong with saying I write for Black folks. It doesn't mean that anybody is excluded from the conversation. No one ever has been excluded from the conversation. It just means that, like, as a Black person with a point of view, coming from my position, it's impossible for me to leave that out of my work. It's like, you all know your mama's cooking. You can, mm-hmm. you can taste it because your mama's in it.
Yeah. How did you balance your point of view with historical fact?
I tried to make sure that I leaned most on 99.999% is just about the historical fact. My point of view came in my voice. Right. And so my POV has everything to do with the tone and the voicing of this information. I think that's sort of where the sweet sauce is.
And to get people a sense of what the tone is, when you first mention race, you follow it with, uh-oh, the R word. And it's also interesting, in the book, there's a graphic sensibility to the book, that certain words are big and certain words are sort of spelled out in different ways. And it really can capture your imagination. What were the conversations like about what the book would look like?
I mean, a lot of that stuff were decisions that I made because those are the things that I do in all of my own novels. I'm always, because I work for kids and write for kids, I'm always thinking about the multitude of stimulation that they have mm-hmm. with cell phones and video games and YouTube and everything else, right? And so books have to sort of mirror that sometimes. And instead of us fighting against it, we should work within it and change the way that we look at these objects that we call books. These are pieces of art like everything else, mm-hmm. right? And as a poet, somebody who came up in poetry first, that was my original discipline and what I was trained in. That's what the poets know. You have license to do whatever you want on the page. Nothing is off limits as long as it's effective, as long as it works. Nothing gratuitous. It needs to work, right? And if it works and it has function, let's go for it.
Right. If it works, if it doesn't work, it's like too much makeup on a pretty lady.
Exactly.
Like, take some of that off.
And I think this is why I thought it would be most effective for a novelist to write this text. You know, a novelist who in many ways is freed from particular writing conventions and has the sort of material in front of him and can really sort of focus in on that child's mind, that child's voice. And I thought that would be the most effective way to deliver this package.
So there's the three categories we talk about a lot in the book, you talk about a lot in the book: segregationist, assimilationist, and anti-racist. Would you mind just going through sort of what each means?
Sure. So segregationist, which we name in the book the haters, which are essentially this idea that you're different from me and thereby you're inferior to me and I don't want anything to do with you. And then there are assimilationists who are like the likers, who like you the more you are like them, who are essentially standardizing themselves and their culture and saying, the more you are like me, the more I'm going to like you. And so for Black people or people of color who have a different culture, mm-hmm. you know, they've been basically asked to transform themselves. But lovers or anti-racist have historically stated that, no, I love you because you're like you. And I love your difference. And we're on the same level. And the reason why there are inequities is not because there's something wrong with you, but there's something wrong with our policies. And we need to change our policies. We don't need to change you.
Jason, why was it important to bring in love?
I think for me, when I think about who I was in high school, in middle school, I was fortunate that I had friends who I knew loved me. But the way that I knew that my friends loved me is because we were nothing alike. And they would show up to my poetry readings, though they had no idea what I was talking about. They would be there in the back, you know, rooting me on. And that's a very real thing. I love you because I accept you as you. I accept the wholeness, the totality, and the diversity that is you. And I think that's something that young people just need to see and need to know, because the pressure is so heavy on them right now, right? And always has been, about whether it be about who they are in the world and in the street, whether it be about how they feel about race and politics. Like, the pressure is heavy, and at the end of the day, they need to know what love looks like moving forward.
My guests are Jason Reynolds and Ibram X. Kendi. We're talking about Stamped. It's a remix of the book Stamped, Racism, Anti-Racism, and You. There's something in the book that I was thinking about all night because it bugged me. So I just want to, it just bothered me. And I just wanted to ask this question. You're really hard on the NAACP in this book. Mm. And the NAACP did so much work for voting rights and for housing rights and desegregation and all the court cases that led up to Brown v. Board and Smith versus Allwright, and we can go on and on and on. You sort of consider them to be in the assimilationist category, but they were trying to work through the legal system to make change for Black folks. So I'm sort of curious why so hard on the NAACP.
Well, it wasn't necessarily hard on the NAACP as an organization as much as some of the individuals within the organization. So to give an example, you know, there were NAACP leaders who did advocate for Black people to assimilate into white American culture, but there were other NAACP leaders who didn't, right? And so it's a very complex sort of organization with many different leaders. And I think we also talked about the Brown decision. And, mm-hmm. And obviously it was great that the court recognized segregated schools as unconstitutional in 1954. But the reason why the Supreme Court did was because they essentially, Chief Justice Earl Warren wrote that segregated schools retard Black children. So essentially, Black schools are retarding Black children, but white schools are not retarding white children. And that's why those Black children in those inferior Black schools need to be moved into those superior white schools. So you can have an anti-racist decision that simultaneously has an assimilationist sort of standpoint. And I think those are the sort of complexities that we wanted to draw out for young people in this book.
Yeah, and I think I'll just, the only thing I'll add is to contextualize this time in history, is to say that the NAACP and many Black people who were fighting on behalf of equity and justice in this country were under intense scrutiny and pressure, right? Mm-hmm. Like their lives were on the line. Mm-hmm. And so they made assimilationist decisions because their lives, many of which because, and some of which because they really believed these things, and others because they knew that what was at stake. And we don't, Dr. Kendi doesn't dismiss their accomplishments, but it does not mean that what they did still wasn't assimilationist, right? Like, we can contextualize it for sure, but it doesn't make it any less assimilationist. And based on the ideas of segregationism, assimilationism, and anti-racism, we just wanted to be honest about the narrative arc of even our heroes, and even in the midst of some of the great things that they've done.
Who's somebody you knew had to be in this book for the kids that you just really felt was so important that they learn about that they most kids don't ever get to hear about?
Angela Davis.
Because?
Honestly, I, and Dr. Kendi has helped me sort of work this out in terms of reading his work. I think Angela Davis is the quintessential anti-racist. I think she sits at the axis point of all the intersections. And has been unwavering in her mission. And as far as I know, has made very, very few, if any, missteps when it comes to being an anti-racist from the beginning, mm-hmm. being very much so pushing the anti-racist the thought process and the anti-racist school of thought forward. And I wish more young people got to learn more about her than just a court case or just, mm-hmm. you know, these sort of sound bites and thin slices that we've given. But Angela Davis by far.
And if I can explain very quickly why, I mean, many Americans have thought there's something wrong with Black poor people. She's rejected that idea. Mm-hmm. Many Americans have thought there's something wrong with Black women. She has challenged that idea. Many Americans have thought there's something wrong with Black prisoners. She has challenged that idea. You go on and on with some of the most vulnerable group, whether it's Black single mothers in the 1980s or Black prisoners
Black
in the 1990s.
Queer people. Mm-hmm.
You know, she has defended these people when other people didn't want to.
The name of the book is Stamped, Racism, Anti-Racism, and You, a remix of the National Book Award winning Stamped from the Beginning. Jason Reynolds, Ibram X. Kendi, thank you so much. You have an event tonight?
Yes. Tonight.
St. Anne's.
St. Anne's. Books are Magic. Check it out. I think it's at 8 o'clock.
All right. We got it in.
Brooklyn.
Brooklyn. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.